Cool. Thank you all for coming today. I'm really excited to be here to talk to you all. So let me give you some background on myself before I get started. I have been at Stanford since 2001. Right now I'm working on finishing my PhD. I've sort of been in and out of VMware during that time as an intern and consultant and employee. My thesis advisor, Mendel Rosenblum, started VMware. And over the course of my PhD career, I've done a lot of work on kind of cool things you can do to use virtualization to make systems more secure, and also, you know, some of the security challenges that arise when you use virtualization. In addition to that, I spend a fair amount of time at VMware consulting about, you know, what should our security architecture look like, and, you know, designing cool new stuff that hopefully we'll be turning into products in the next 5 years. So before I get started, I should, you know, present this disclaimer. You know, none of this has been filtered by any sort of official marketing personnel. Anything you hear and repeat anywhere, I will totally disavow any knowledge of, except for I do have a final slide at the end for any press folks that are looking for quotes. So, so to start out, I'm going to give a little bit of background on VMMs. This talk is basically two parts. Number one is kind of, you know, blazing through a bunch of the hype that I tend to hear a lot about. And, you know, the hype thing is sort of, I don't know if this is sort of an issue near and dear to my heart so much as a point of, like, you know, I have to have many conversations about, you know, this makes sense in terms of architecture, this doesn't make sense, you know, read things in the press, I see things in publications, I hear things from customers. And I think because of the fact, you know, virtualization is kind of this new big thing, it's disruptive, and, you know, a lot of people just kind of haven't been exposed to it before, there's a lot of confusion around it. So, you know, going to touch on a couple of issues there and kind of then, you know, take more deep dive into the, you know, what do VMM architectures look like and what implications do those have for security? The second kind of big piece is what happens when you actually use virtualization in the world? What happens when, you know, people roll these things out? How does this affect your AV and your firewall and just, you know, kind of what falls over when you took these, you know, physical static boxes and you turn them into these software entities that you can, you know, clone and copy around and hot migrate? I'm going to, you know, begin with a little bit of background on virtualization. Unfortunately, some of the material in this talk, you kind of need to have some depth in terms of, you know, understanding, you know, how hypervisors are built, you know, how they're used in practice. I'll try to, you know, I've sort of tried to include as much of that as possible, and hopefully if there's some confusion that comes up, we can deal with that with questions. So to start out, Virtual Machine Monitor is this kind of an operating system that runs operating systems, the way I like to put it. You know, people seem sometimes confused, like, you know, oh, well, you can write a rootkit for it. Well, of course, you know, it's an operating system. You know, people like to make generalizations, then if you start with that, they're like, oh, operating systems are insecure. Well, no, I mean, operating systems can be, you know, 10,000 lines of code or 10 million lines of code, and they can sort of, you know, do anything or nothing. So, I mean, you know, nothing simply follows from the fact that we're saying, you know, this is an operating system, except for the fact that, you know, we know it has some pretty common pieces. You're going to have scheduling, memory management, I/O, whatnot. Virtual machine monitors have a lot of different goals. You know, the common ones are software compatibility, right? You want to provide this common layer where you don't have to worry about driver hell when you're trying to manage a bunch of machine images. You know, when you put an image out there, it's always going to just work. Low overhead and high performance, and then sort of efficient, fair resource multiplexing. So efficiency and fairness are two really kind of critical things with the design of VMMs. The reason I'm bringing this up and kind of highlighting it is because later on I'm going to be talking about why virtual machine monitors are designed the way they're designed, and performance is actually a really critical thing, and I'll talk in a moment about, like, sort of a more concrete example of why this is so important. You know, isolation is kind of the default model here. One of the reasons that people really like virtualization for security is that, you know, if you've ever tried to take an administrator and explain to them, well, you have these two applications and here's this, you know, SE Linux policy that separates them, like, you know, God help you if you hope that they'll understand what's going on there. With virtualization, it's very easy to be like, well, you know, here's these, you know, two virtual machines and here's this firewall and here's some firewall rules. Like, it's very easy for people to wrap their head around the security model. It's kind of a surprising thing, right, that, like, at some point, if you don't give people simple enough metaphors, security just breaks down. And then another big piece here is, you know, virtual machines encapsulate all your state. And the way I like to put this is, you know, is a virtual machine is a machine. It needs to be, you know, patched, maintained. You know, it has all the kind of needs of a normal machine, and it's also a file, right? You can copy it, you can specialize it, you can, you know, store it in a, you know, a form as a set of diffs. You know, everything you sort of every intuition you have about here's what I could do with a file is something you can also do with a virtual machine. So where is virtualization today? This is actually a really important thing because, you know, often when you kind of have these discussions about virtualization, like, you know, well, if you use virtualization in blah, blah, blah scenario, you know, foo could happen. Why didn't vendors deal with this? And if you look at kind of why vendors, you know, choose to implement the features they've chosen or, you know, the kind of the threat models they're considering or like the, you know, threat environment and the best practices that they expect, right? That's very much driven by like who's going to be using this and what is a reasonable expectation for them. So the reality is today is that most of where virtualization is rolled out is in, you know, big and mid-level enterprise, right? Fortune 100% of Fortune 1000, or sorry, Fortune 100 companies use VMware products, 91% of Fortune 1000. I'm not trying to sort of have the VMware bias. It's very easy for me to kind of get what the numbers are for VMware. You know, there's, you know, lots, you know, I have friends at these other companies that are doing great stuff. This is not a knock on anyone. And then the other thing is, right, this is sort of, you know, predominantly Windows VMs and predominantly business applications. And the business applications point is, again, sort of important from a performance perspective. You know, when you're running things like Exchange, they tend to be very I/O sensitive. So, you know, one of the things that, I'd love to see is, you know, kind of, you know, more crypto at the virtualization layer. People sort of bring this up all the time. And, you know, unfortunately with these things, they end up being very, like, sensitive to IO, right? So when you've got, you know, things like Exchange, SAP, if you, like, you know, put something, you know, that slows down their IO path at all, you see these pretty big perturbations. And this is why, you know, with virtualization, you know, it's really kind of driving the adoption of SANs, right? People want, like, as many bits as quickly as they can get them. And again, you know, there's many other environments for this stuff. This is again the common case. This is not everywhere. So, to kind of provide my last point on the consolidation, on the kind of performance and efficiency point. So, this is one nice example I like to give. There's a public utility in Texas that adopted VMware, and this was sort of the story for consolidation before and after, right? You have this like massive reduction in the number of physical servers you need. Your storage configuration changes as well. Again, you sort of see that move to much higher performance storage because of the fact you've got, you know, more machines on fewer boxes, so you need to get more bits in and out quickly. So, you know, 2 points. Again, the I/O point that I'll iterate, and the other one is that, again, you have to be kind of, you know, careful about efficiencies, right? When you throw away, like, you know, 2x performance here and there, that translates into, like, 2x more physical machines, 2x more power. So there's, you know, there's big numbers associated with efficiencies in these systems. So now to the hype. There's all manner of hype. I can't go into the sort of my, you know, why this is bogus or why this isn't necessarily something you need to spend your time on. Here, I've written other papers about it. Other people have given great presentations on this stuff. The sort of my favorite big red herring, and actually I don't need to talk about it because you'll get, you know, a few more hours of this as soon as I finish my talk, are VM-based rootkits and VMM detection. VMM detection is kind of a funny issue. This is sort of like, you go to VMware engineers and you ask them, can you detect that it's VMware? Can you detect that it's a virtual machine? And they're like, of course. I mean, you know, why would you, if you were Toyota, or, you know, if you're Mercedes, why would you want people to think, look, I'm, you know, running on a Toyota or, you know, Volvo, whatever. With VM-based rootkits, I think the basic just issue here is that, I mean, virtualization just doesn't seem to be a useful way to hide yourself. Again, we have a paper on HotOS called Compatibility is Not Transparency. Tom and Nate gave a great talk on this last year. I don't feel like I need to belabor this point. It's also something that's kind of orthogonal to, like, if you want to roll out virtualization, right? Like, whether or not this is true, this doesn't really affect you if you're rolling out stuff in a virtualization or, like, you know, in a data center or really sort of doing anything with, like, I'm going to use virtual machines to do stuff. You know, that said, I think it's pretty bogus, but... So the kind of, you know, next fun point of hype is, again, like, you know, as soon as somebody can get the handle on something having to do with security, you know, blah, 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 virtualization, world is coming to an end. Secure VM migration, right? You can man in the middle hot migration when you're migrating one virtual machine from one platform to another. It's kind of like process migration. And this is sort of not a profound insight, right? If you kind of look at the, this is not a knock on those guys, but the reason that people do this is because, again, they're very concerned with, like, you know, what's your downtime going to be when you migrate this thing? The best practice people do is they just actually migrate this over a physically separate network. And, you know, physically separate is sort of, you know, the gold standard for isolation there. Sort of ironic since I'm talking about virtualization. sort of the discrepancies between real and virtual networks. Oh, you know, your virtual switch doesn't have, you know, blah, 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 VLAN feature. I'm like, okay, fine. If a customer cares, it'll get fixed next week. If you think it's an issue, talk to somebody. Somebody will, like, fix 50 lines of code. Awesome. And again, storage encryption, it's an awesome thing. I'd really like to see more of it. Right now, for where virtualization is mostly used, the, you know, performance is a problem, and key management is also sort of a big onerous thing. I mean, this is sort of, you know, in general, why you don't see more storage encryption in these markets, right? If people really care, they go out and they spend, you know, 50 or 100 or 1,000 or however much on a decrew box. But it's, you know, it's kind of a fairly onerous thing. It's, you know, not sort of, yeah, here or there with respect to virtualization. The size fixation. This is another thing. It's fixating on size is not just for the porn industry anymore. So I really like this quote. With only 20,000 lines of code, KVM is simpler to develop and maintain than 300,000 lines Xen. The funny thing is, right, because I can remember when Xen was like 50,000 lines of code. When I saw this, I actually sent email to one of my friends who was the storage lead on Xen, and I was like, dude, like, you guys just need to stop writing code because, like, you're creating all these problems for security and maintainability. Like, clearly, you know, there's no way you can add value. If anything, just start, like, ripping out directories. And it's kind of bizarre. And I'll sort of go on, you know, talk more about this. And this kind of ties into my bigger point with the architecture hype, right? So, you know, you've got people talking about microkernelized hypervisors and, you know, bare metal hypervisors and thin hypervisors and, well, it's, you know, this one is more secure because it's a type 1 hypervisor versus a type 2 hypervisor. And this is cool and I don't know. I mean, I've been working on this stuff for a better, you know, good 7 years, academic, written lots of papers about this stuff, and I often just don't know what the hell people are talking about here. So, I mean, this would be, again, you know, architecture A, far more secure than architecture B, where, you know, B is any of these things, and then people, you know, put some stuff in here. And I don't want to, you know, point fingers at individual companies, because there's, you know, plenty of fingers to be pointed, you know, all around. But that's sort of, you know, what they talk about is today, is sort of, you know, more architecture, less hype. I'm going to talk about, you know, why do we have these different architectures? Why do we have, you know, hosted? Why do we have, you know, ESX in the way it looks? Why do we have this kind of, you know, thin model of Xen and Hyper-V? And, you know, my basic hypothesis is that, you know, basically all architectures currently kind of look identical from a security perspective, right? You can sort of spend a lot of time talking about, well, you know, this box lives here and it's protected from this thing and this box is bigger, this box is smaller. And it all sort of seems like bullshit. And, you know, I sort of, you know, wasn't sort of sitting in my office at VMware and kind of thinking this, like, you know, sort of kick it around with folks in various places, and we all seem to be like, yeah, I don't really know what you guys are talking about. So how do we kind of get at this? You know, when, you know, people come out and like, well, you know, why don't you just make the hypervisor 10,000 lines is something I like to hear, or I hear frequently when I'm on panels. So let's, you know, to address this, I want to basically, you know, show how these architectures evolved. Try to understand, you know, well, why are the pieces there? Why are they doing what they're doing? Give the rationale from the progression, you know, from one architecture to the next. And, you know, and see, like, you know, in every case, right, your attack surface remains the same and the impact of a compromise remains the same. So, I mean, there's kind of two things here. Again, it's like, what's the attack surface, you know, of this thing? What are the security implications of this architecture? And, you know, if somebody's like, well, you know, I mean, if you understand why an architecture is the way it is, you're not going to think, ah, oh, okay, they did this to make it secure. You're going to understand, ah, oh, they did this because, you know, handling interrupts is really expensive if you have to take an extra context switch. So the scope of the discussion is going to focus on, you know, VM escapes, sort of how hard is it to bust out of the guest. There are other, you know, major attack surfaces on a virtualization platform, right? There's, you know, you've got your management VM, which is running your management applications, and you can say, you know, how is it to, you know, kind of break in from that interface, but I don't think that's sort of, you know, super interesting to discuss because this basically just boils down to host security, right? Those are normal user-level applications. They run off on a separate management network. This is, you know, kind of nothing new for folks, right? If the usage model of your VMM is, you know, it looks like an appliance, then breaking that thing is probably like breaking an appliance with that given attack service. If it looks like, you know, a normal operating system, you know, with, you know, a bunch of stuff running, and I mean, it's, this is sort of, you know, old hat here. You know, again, we have like the applications, you know, talking directly to the virtual network. There's an attack surface there with a driver, your virtual switch, but it's sort of beyond the scope of our talk. You know, VM escapes is like the new hotness and the sexy thing, so that's where our attention is going to stay. So, again, going back, kind of a note on terminology. So, virtual machine monitor, the term is used kind of in two ways. Number one is kind of the whole, operating system layer thing that sits underneath all of your guest operating systems. The other one is just this piece that provides this kind of new process abstraction that looks just like underlying hardware. So it can kind of either be a piece of a hypervisor or it can be the whole thing. In this talk, I'm going to sort of try to standardize on this terminology. If your VMM is this thing that provides this new process abstraction, right? So it's the thing that virtualizes your MMU and kind of gives you this new set of page tables for these guest operating systems. It's the thing that takes advantage of CPU virtualization features in the hardware, either the sort of VTNS VM stuff we had in AMD or with VMware, right? We sort of used binary translation for a long time to give the guest operating system the illusion that it's actually running directly on the hardware and kind of hide some of the blemishes in the x86 about virtualizing the instruction set. And then the other piece of this is there's usually kind of a user space helper process. I'm not going to say like a whole lot about this. It seems to be something that's basically everywhere. This user space process in KVM is QMU or sort of better parts of QMU. I found it in Hyper-V. It's called the worker process. Thanks, Brandon. You're awesome. In VMware, it's called VMX, which is sort of confuses this terminology with these virtualization extensions for the hardware, but we chose the name first. So anyway, the kind of only interesting point there is that just because you own like something in that is sort of perceived to be part of your virtual machine monitor doesn't mean you own the whole machine. But I'll sort of talk about that in a second. So our primary attack surface kind of for our monitor is number one, the kernel resident piece. And with kernel resident, in some places this is in this kind of bare metal hypervisor, in some places it's your host operating system. But basically, the thing that virtualizes our CPU and memory sort of across the board always lives somewhere where if you own that piece, you own the whole platform, like game over. And the reason for that is performance. That's bottom line, we sort of don't need to say a whole lot more about that. You do have this helper app, or sort of helper and user space that can deal with device emulation, things like this. And the implications of a compromise there are, like always and for everyone, you're going to completely own the VM that thing was associated with. Although if you can get at that thing, you've probably already owned that guest operating system anyway. And then this sort of gets into implementation details of how much privilege have you given to that helper. And this is sort of going to vary on version and implementation and blah. So I'm not going to touch on that in this bigger architecture discussion. So there's some secondary attack surfaces, right? When your device emulation code wants to talk to something, it has to talk to a console OS or DOM 0. It needs to allocate memory. It needs to do I/O. And so there's going to be some sort of system call interface typically that's involved with doing that. And then there's going to be an I/O stack, right? You're going to need to take these bits that are coming to your virtual NIC, and you're going to need to, at some point, get them down to an actual device driver that's going to put those bits on the wire. I mean, again, these pieces, if you can kind of compromise the things behind this, if you can compromise that, whatever's behind that system call interface, if it's an operating system, or that I/O stack, typically it's game over. And this is for functional reasons as well as performance reasons. So to start out, I'm going to kind of provide this evolutionary view of like why did architectures end up the way they did. A key point here is, again, your virtual machine monitor is an operating system that runs operating systems. Operating systems have lots of pieces we want to reuse. For example, there's really only two driver stacks out there, right? There's a Linux driver stack and there's a Windows driver stack. Folks like VMware right now, we have an SDK, people are starting to develop for it, but basically, it's been 10 years to get things off the ground, and still for sort of the common case, you need to have some big pool of drivers to pull from if you want to have something that people are going to use in the real world. And so that means you're going to have to reuse somebody's driver stack. For sort of bootstrapping, as anybody who's kind of done software engineering knows, there's two ways to do it. You either sort of start with your editor and your compiler and you remake the world, or you say look, there's some other stuff over here that kind of looks like the stuff I want, and maybe it doesn't quite work the way I want, but I'll try to get things running and then gradually replace pieces as I find that they don't quite fit my needs. And this is the path that kind of everybody has taken because it seems to be the most rational way to do this. So the simplest thing to do if I want a virtual machine monitor is to take my existing operating system that has all these good things I want and add a VM abstraction. And you know, this is exactly what VMware Workstation does, what Virtual PC does, what Parallels does. And so basically, I take this monitor piece, and I kind of wedge that down into my kernel, load it as a kernel module. And this is something that's basically independent of the operating system. With VMware, this is actually like literally an independent blob that, you know, if you're running on Mac, or if you're running on Linux, or if you're running on Windows, or even if you're running on ESX, like, that's, you know, an independent binary. It gets linked separately, and there's like this really kind of clean interface between it and the rest of the stuff that manages resources and schedules things and does I/O and all that good stuff. Oh, that's exciting. We're experiencing some technical difficulties here. We can solve this. We have the technology. Sorry about that. So we're back. So this is kind of our simplest way to go. So what's the benefits of the approach? Again, it's great. We get maximum reuse. We're OS agnostic, so we can, you know, build this thing, and it, you know, lets us run our, you know, you're like me and you spent, you know, I don't know, a lot of years just using, you know, PowerPoint as your only Windows application. You can now run PowerPoint on your Mac or on your Linux box or wherever you need to run it. Nobody has to go and, you know, develop a ton of new code to do that. But unfortunately, this approach, right, has some pretty serious limitations, right? It really limits how we manage resources. We are not getting intimately involved with the operating system. So basically, we ask the operating system when we install this monitor, you know, like, give me some chunk of memory. I can sort of, you know, let some go or get some back, but I can't, like, do a whole lot of interesting stuff with respect to how I manage memory and with respect to how the operating system manages memory. And the other thing is that helper process that I had there, it lives at the whim of the OS scheduler, right? So this is going to kind of impose some serious limits on what I can do, both in terms of accounting for how resources are used, imposing like strict discipline in terms of fairness. And so if we could kind of one step further, you can sort of, you know, bake this VMM into your OS. So this has some nice benefits. This is, again, the route that the Linux KVM folks have gone. First benefit is a political benefit. You don't lose control of the hardware, and you sort of don't lose control of your fate. And I think it's an exaggeration to say, I mean, there's certainly a sense of, you know, the Linux guys think that, you know, we know the right way to do this. We don't really want to have Xen running underneath us and sort of be relegated to middleware or VMware or who else. So we're going to try to, you know, build in this virtualization primitive. So there's the political angle. Tighter integration with resource management. You do get a lot of flexibility in terms of how you're going to design this thing if you sort of deeply enmesh it with your operating system. It's not clear from a software engineering perspective what the implications of this are, right? And basically now you have you know, two radically different process abstractions that have radically different needs from the scheduler, from the memory manager. So if you just kind of want to run some stuff and, you know, things work okay, that's great. You know, if you want to take your big enterprise workload and you know, get, kind of get your resource management needs met, get your fairness needs met, get that efficiency, it's not clear how this is going to work out. So that's kind of an experiment in progress, and I'm interested to see how it goes. So a fun myth is that hosted architectures are less secure than bare metal architectures. So for stuff that runs on your desktop, I mean, this reputation has actually come from, you know, more than just these architecture arguments. It's come from, you know, people will see more exploits in these desktop things. One of them is, you know, you see more bugs in these things, and it's just because, you know, you have Parallels and Virtual PC, and like a variety of different things, you know, Workstation as well. Like, you know, there's been more stuff in this space, just more bugs. This is, you know, there's some bad code out there, not architecture. You see more stuff on by default. So, you know, in a desktop environment, you actually do want a lot of sharing, right? You like to share folders. You like to do drag and drop. Things like this just open up, like, more attack surfaces. So this is, I mean, it's kind of, you know, different from the server case. This is, you know, again, not tied to architecture. This is tied to how you configure the thing. And again, you know, as I noted with VMware, right, like, this, I mean, your kind of core monitor is basically the same for all platforms. And then this, you know, kind of that monitor piece really for everyone looks the same. You know, has to kind of satisfy the same needs of, you know, virtualizing CPU, virtualizing memory. So again, kind of our attack surfaces don't change. And there's kind of no change, we kind of know our liability, right? We know the pieces that that break if these things get owned. So the next step is we can put a hypervisor underneath the OS. And this is the route that, you know, the Xen and Hyper-V have gone. This provides you a lot of great benefits. Again, on the opposite political side, you don't have to fight with the OS developers, right? You don't have to convince them this is a good idea. You can develop your stuff independently. From a software engineering perspective, this may be like a much cleaner way of doing things. The big thing, though, is you have control over resource management, right? You have total control over scheduling. You can go off and do your crazy thing. You don't have to worry about how normal processes run. So you can worry about multi-core. You can worry about NUMA. You have a much longer quanta when you're scheduling a VM versus when you're scheduling a process. It behooves you to make more intelligent decisions. You know, fairness is something that's kind of nice in a desktop operating system. You know, multi-tenancy is not the common case. Running a lot of different applications that are interacting is not the common case. With virtual machine monitors, fairness and resource isolation are, again, really key. There's co-scheduling processors within a given VM and then co-scheduling VMs together. You know, more control over memory management, again, in large pages. There's just, managing memory for a process, managing memory for a VM, two very, very different things. Much bigger working sets, much different patterns in the working sets. Overcommit works differently and that you need to worry about this about at two levels instead of just saying, okay, you know, I've got some stuff running here, I'm going to swap it out. You know, if you try to play this game with a normal process, this works fine, right? The operating says, you know, here's the least recently used pages, I'm going to throw them out on disk. If you try to play this game at the virtual machine level, what's going to happen is you can get into the situation, you can start doing this, and then the operating system, when it sees, okay, I'm in an overcommit situation as well, it's going to also start try to swap out those least recently used pages. So your virtual machine monitor just swap those out. First thing that, when that guest goes to touch those, is going to happen is it's going to read those pages back in, and then it's going to swap them out again. So you get these, you know, weird interactions. So basically, there's a lot of things you want to do differently from a resource management perspective for virtual machines. So it's great. Now we have these, you know, these things like Xen, Hyper-V. Did we get more security? No, it seems like we have the same attack surface. Again, you have your CPU virtualization, your memory virtualization that's in there. You know, your IO stack and all this stuff, you know, lives in this DOM 0 and the separate OS over here. But, you know, that, those things can still do bus mastering. And, you know, even if you can sort of prevent them from doing bus mastering, that's, I mean, that's still your storage stack and your IO stack. And so if somebody can do malicious stuff over there, it's, you know, kind of, you still don't feel very good about the fact that, you know, all your storage has been compromised. We can do some things to address this, and I'll kind of talk about this more at the end. So these architectures have a lot of nice properties. There's still some practical problems you encounter with these architectures. One of them is during, so kind of what's going on here with this DOM 0 OS, right? This is where your device drivers live. This is where your IO stack lives. When you have interrupts coming in that your drivers need to handle, like a CPU needs to be dedicated to that thing. I mean, not sort of dedicated in terms of it's absolutely pinned, but it needs to have a CPU to like handle those things, to handle your IO. What this basically means is that if you get into a situation where you actually want to use that CPU to run VMs and you have a high IO load, you're going to spend, basically you're either going to just kind of have to end up pinning that whole CPU on your VM that's doing IO, however many CPUs it needs, it's sort of going to grab a big chunk of them. And your scheduler is going to have to do something intelligent there to just, you know, hand over a big chunk. Or you're going to end up thrashing back and forth, trying to, you know, hand out some of that CPU and then also use it to do I.O. So things get kind of nasty. The other thing is, how do you do fair accounting? Like, how do you know what happened to those resources that that DOM 0 OS was using, right? When you do resource management, you're saying, you know, how many cycles did this VM use? And if I'm spending a lot of time handling incoming packets, for that VM in a driver that lives in that DOM 0, that's completely opaque to me, right? So I have this kind of partition between my resource management where I can't do accounting for, you can't instrument and see, and then you can't enforce limits between these two sides. So it's problematic. The answer to this is you slurp the IO stack into the hypervisor. And this is the route that ESX has ended up going. And again, it's sort of from this evolutionary perspective, I see that, I mean, you have kind of all the same properties you have with Xen and Hyper-V in ESX in terms of your scheduling and resource management, and then you just kind of do one step further with, you know, pulling things down. So everything sort of grows naturally out of each other. Then there's a sense that drivers are bad. Academics are terribly afraid of device drivers. At some point, Dawson Engler wrote this paper where he took his static analysis stuff and he found like 500 bugs in device drivers, and like everybody in the academic community is like, oh my god, device drivers are the worst thing ever. And, you know, they forgot about the fact that plenty of network drivers are like 4,000 lines of code. I mean, so, you know, statistically, device drivers are very bad. If you can say, like, here's the drivers I'm going to use, I'm going to go through and like look at them and QA them and kind of, you know, dial them in for this platform, the implications are very different. But anyway, so this is a interesting issue. Again, it's sort of the, people have this emotional reaction to drivers. It's not clear that's always warranted. I mean, again, on the Windows side, they've had lots of trauma with NVIDIA. I'm very sorry for them. In any case, so should this be a big concern for us that our drivers are now in the kernel? I don't think this is a big concern. I mean, number one, of course, we have the same liability that we do with DOM 0, right? If you own your drivers, you still own the machine. The second thing is that the data that actually ends up being going to that driver goes through a very narrow interface, right? That you're basically like reading and writing data to that thing. Typically, when you're going and owning drivers, it's because they have these big, wide interface. You have ioctls, you have weird things you can do with your video card. Okay, so you know, what's the point of, you know, sort of all this discussion? I sort of led you down this path to explain why are things architected this way, that we basically have the same attack surface, you know, at each point. And my sort of, you know, argument here is that, again, that all these architectures look the same from a security standpoint. I mean, implementations are going to differ, configurations are going to differ, but, you know, when people start talking about their thin hypervisor and, you know, this and that, it's usually bullshit. The differences between these things, you know, are driven by very real concerns, right? Software engineering, performance, ease of implementation, you know, political concerns about who wants to have control of the stack. Another thing here is, and I didn't kind of, you know, touch on too much, but right, code size needs to be considered in context. You'll notice in each of these cases, right, if you have a host operating system, you know, that can potentially be some huge chunk of code. If you have this DOM 0, there could be some huge chunk of code. You know, there could be some big chunk of code off your operating system. But if it doesn't talk to, you know, anything where it can get, you know, be attacked, if you have some code that's, you know, sitting off on the side, you know, talking to some, you know, local device on the host doing power management or whatnot, it's not clear that you, I mean, really care about this from a security standpoint. So the question becomes, you know, can architecture actually improve things? And this kind of comes down to another point in OS design, right? The kind of extreme end of microkernel thought is you want to basically have, you know, your kernel that gives you address spaces and threads, you know, and sort of thinking on kind of various research operating systems, some of the stuff that's out there. Basically, you want to have kind of, you know, everything out of the kernel as much as possible. And this is, you know, sort of one of the, you know, why don't you have a 10,000 line hypervisor thinking comes from. You know, for sort of the core things that you have there in today's hypervisors, like this is completely impractical and makes no sense. For scheduling, you know, building a two-level scheduler is sort of, from a practical perspective, very, very difficult. If you have to take a context switch every time you want to ask your scheduler, what should I do, this is very hard. And nobody's really figured out and sort of demonstrated we can actually rip these things out. Also, these things have no attack surface, so it's not clear why you would ever care to not have this in your hypervisor. Memory management is also, it's kind of a funny thing. Well, you know, you could run this thing off in a separate process, but again, if you've compromised your memory manager, then you can get it all the memory on the system, and so, I mean, you've contained that thing, but you still own everything on the system, so it's not clear why you care. I mean, maybe you can't bus master, but who cares? And so, yeah, there's a huge amount of trust in that thing, and again, it's kind of hard to modularize. And these are, you know, I think good questions in general to ask, you know, if somebody's like, well, you know, if only we could isolate blah, well, ask yourself these questions, right? Like, what's the trust relationship there? And, you know, is this actually going to buy me anything? So the other side of this is I think there's actually some things that you can compartmentalize and that can make life better. Compartmentalization basically means you can throw this thing in a less privileged processor mode when you run it. You can give it its own page table so it can't just go and scribble all over memory. And, of course, you can protect it from bus mastering and just, you know, DMAing stuff all over the place. So one strategy for this is you can, you know, use this IOMU to kind of confine your drivers in IO stack. This is something that you can kind of very easily, you know, see how you either throw this DOM 0 model or if your drivers are down in your kernel. You move your driver off either into its own VM or its own process. The difference between a VM and a process is basically the processor protection mode you use, right? If it's using, you know, the VT hardware and from, you know, the application's perspective, it can enable and disable interrupts, then that's a virtual machine. And if it's running in CPL3 and it can't do some of these things, then it's a process, right? This is the distinction between a VM and a process. Otherwise, these things are completely identical, right? They're running in their own address space. Another way you can kind of approach this is, you know, let's say you can confine this DOM 0 to not being able to do bad DMA stuff. You can protect, I mean, one way to, you know, protect your data is, of course, to encrypt it before it gets handed off to that component. This ends up being very expensive. I don't want to kind of go too far down this digression. I think this is something that's coming. A lot of vendors are looking at, like, how do we rip out some of these more sensitive pieces? Hardware virtualization support is enabling this. It's still a little bit expensive, but it's coming along. Something that kind of held up microkernels for the last decade is the fact that context switches are really expensive on the x86. This is because of the fact that every time you do a context switch, you have to do a full flush of your TLB, which basically means that every time you need to now access a new entry after you've done a context switch, you have to do like a full hardware page table walk to repopulate your TLB. And then IOUs are going to give us DMA protection. All of these things are there, but not quite there yet. Like, things are still a little bit half-baked. Again, I don't want to sort of go rattle too much on this. So I think this is coming. I don't think that these changes are going to be massive. I don't think it, is particularly going to affect end users one way or another. I think for people like me who are like, I want to architect the most secure hypervisor and like really get off on like context switches and like interrupt handling and TLB flushes, like it's going to be awesome. And for everyone else, I don't think it's going to make a practical difference either in the effect of like real compromises, or really even like, there's a lot of benefits with respect to fault isolation, but most of the time you don't actually care about fault isolation for things like drivers. Why is this the case? If your driver crashes, that means your server is unavailable. It doesn't really matter if that fault was isolated. Your server is now unavailable. So, but people get excited about, okay, my driver can crash. Potentially, I can restart it. Maybe the hardware at some point may reach there, and I think that's going to be another few years as well. Okay, so this is like a total shift. If that went sort of too far on the like how you build hypervisors, oh my god, this is really boring. Now this is going to go too high level into the fluffy. Here's how you use hypervisors. So I've kind of got enough material in my talk to make sure everybody is unhappy, regardless of your interests. So lots of fun things kind of happen when you virtualize stuff. Something I encountered kind of fairly early on working at VMware is that traditional IT was not built with VMs in mind. VMware was one of the earliest big users of virtualization, so lots of bad things that happened to us first, and still happen to us, because we're sort of the pathological case for virtualization usage, right? Like, if you have, virtualization enables like really rapid scaling, you can kind of have, all sorts of diversity, but if you can have lifecycle management and all these kind of different things that allow you to kind of enforce IT process on that, then a lot of these problems just go away. Unfortunately, when you're in a development environment, you don't have any process like that. And so like shit just ends up chaotic on the engineering network. And like I don't really know what to do about that. Not the problem we're going to talk about today. So over the years I've seen there are kind of some common patterns that crop up. Scale, diversity are like two big things that exacerbate stuff. Not going to talk too much about that today. I've written some stuff about in the past. You can check out my publications if you're interested. The three things I'm going to talk on are transients, kind of the VMs frequently coming and going, mobility, and then this kind of change from real to virtual time. And so I think these are kind of three patterns. If you kind of understand what the changes are, you can look for these, and it'll help you get some insight into, when I change my infrastructure from real to virtual, or when this component changed from real to virtual, what are the things I can look for? It's useful for, I think, if you're a system integrator and you're like, okay, does this architecture make sense? It's useful if you're a security analyst and you're looking for, is there something here that I can break? So traditional machines, you have relatively low churn, right? You plug the machine into the physical machine, you plug it in, it's there on the network. In virtual environments, machines tend to come and go much more frequently. You have snapshots that are coming up and down, suspend and resume. It's really easy and kind of low cost to create VMs, so you just end up having more of them. So you can potentially end up with a very large transient population. So the first thing that like really drove this home was an experience that we had at VMware. Back in 2003, when like sort of droves of worms roamed the earth, and there was a new remote exploit on XP, like every month, and people spent millions of dollars kind of doing cleanup on this. At VMware, we'd sort of like everyone else have this experience that periodically we'd get like a paid day off. You'd come in, like the network would be totally hosed because it was down because of worm traffic, and so you go out and shoot the shit with everyone else. So in a traditional environment, what would typically happen, right, is that you have a bunch of machines that would get infected. Your IT guys would do a fire drill and go and patch all these machines. And you sort of, your infection curve would kind of come back to flatline and you'd move on until, like, a few months later when Code Red 2 would come out. We didn't actually seem to be that lucky. What seemed to happen with us is, you know, you'd have, you know, your big infection would initially come on, and then it would go away, but then it would come back, and then it will go, you know, do their fire drill, go away. And you have these oscillations and it never seemed to go away. And it's like, well, why is this? And it seemed that, like, we were kind of large enough on the engineering side with our virtual machines coming and going that, you know, you'd always have some virtual machines that were up but hadn't been infecting yet. So you hadn't noticed they were spewing garbage, and so they weren't patched. And then you'd have some virtual machines that would come up, get infected, and then go down. And so it's sort of like in a real population, people would come and go and, like, reinfect the population, and so you kind of get these continued outbreaks. And so transience kind of leads to these really weird emergent phenomena. So, you know, what does transience cause? I mean, number one is kind of this, you know, loss of visibility. If things aren't online, you can't patch them. You can't, your vulnerability scan isn't going to see them. And if they're spewing shit, well, they won't be spewing shit on the network, which is sort of a mixed blessing, right? If everything at least, you know, spews shit on the network at once, you can go and, you know, turn off all those ports and your life sort of resumes some level of normalcy. Another unhappy thing that happens with transience is that, you know, lots of stuff is kind of used to being online regularly, right? So if you are a frequent, you know, virtual machine user for, like, you know, test and dev stuff, and you actually happen to have AV running in there, right? When you have to rescan things if, you know, they haven't been in run for a while, or, you know, patch updates, right? It's just sort of, it sucks being a user when your tools didn't have this expectation that there was going to be transience there. And then finally, right, you know, you get this kind of time dilation effect. Something that was going to be online, the usability was designed with that expectation. You know, key aging, password expiration. You have this VM, you use it infrequently. Every time you use it, you have to change the password. Again, it's just, this is sort of not, you know, like things fundamentally break. It's just that things become fundamentally more irritating. How do we cope with this? So we have to consider both, like, how and when we patch. The, you know, how part is, you have to think about, you know, can I do this offline? Can I do this, you know, while the user isn't there? Or can I, you know, do this out of band? There's a number of ways to do this. One thought would be, you know, you can kind of do this on a loopback file system. This is pretty sweet. It's a nice way to do things. Totally doesn't work with snapshots or with anything where you've actually got in-memory state which has been saved because of metadata consistency. If anybody has any ideas on, like, how to fix this, that would be awesome. Another way to do this is you can bring the virtual machine back up in a sandbox. Patch it, then bring it back down. You can sort of, you could either apply that patching out of line or in line. You know, out of line through some backdoor if, you know, that sort of, you felt the inclination to do that, or just using your normal patch management. Again, this works well, but it perturbs your workload, which sucks. If you actually snapshot of that machine and you expect it to be in a particular state, you don't want to bring it back up and have that state magically change. So there's some interesting challenges. I don't know if kind of any panacea here yet. But yeah, it'd be interesting to hear people's thoughts. So second big area that you see interesting stuff is mobility. And mobility has all sorts of different forms, right? So mobility can be in hot migration. It's something we use a lot in VMware. Today it happens on a common subnet. I think tomorrow it's going to move sort of wider across the enterprise, you know, maybe one day onto the wide area. It's sort of a really useful primitive in lots of situations. You can, of course, copy VMs around with SCP. You know, they're sort of, share them with your distributed file system, put them on a USB stick. So what problems arise? I mean, first, right, today's networks weren't built with mobility in mind. You know, laptops already sort of, you know, tease out some of these problems. Static firewall rules, you know, they expect this MAC address is going to be somewhere, you know, plugging to a physical port in my network, or this IP address is going to be somewhere in this physical topology. You know, set up some firewalls with the assumption that, like, okay, you know, this traffic is going to come through this firewall, and as soon as you start kind of moving your end hosts, you know, that fragile dependency you set up between your routing and your enforcement mechanism starts getting kind of janky, and, you know, before you know it, those sort of rules you thought were being enforced aren't being enforced anymore. You know, VLANs can help you with this. You can say, well, everything will just always kind of be on this common subnet and always put a firewall at the edge. The problem with this is that your topologies start looking pretty dumb pretty quick. You would like to have some more intelligence with respect to, you know, where are my enforcement mechanisms? I don't necessarily want to say, you know, everything from this VLAN goes through this firewall, you know, if this firewall is, you know, living somewhere across the campus or somewhere at a different site. Other problems, networks are stateless in theory. This is sort of the story that networking people like to tell you. This, of course, isn't true. There's a huge amount of state there. For firewalling, it's usually stateful. You want to keep some per connection state. As we move like more into NIPS and you know other stuff that's doing like full flow reconstruction, there's a huge amount of state associated with a given flow that's being kept in the network. So why is this a problem? Well, you take, I mean, let's say you're going to vMotion a virtual machine from one place to another. You had a NIPS box that was in front of it. And especially if your enforcement element is living in another virtual machine that's on that same platform, all of a sudden, you migrated over to another place where maybe there's another enforcement element, but it doesn't know about any of your existing flows. So things basically could just break horribly. This is kind of another interesting area where, you know, like, folks are frequently like, you know, I'd like a snoop port on my virtual switch so I can kind of, you know, look at all the traffic that's going through. And, you know, of course, because of this fact that when things move around that you lose the state, it looks kind of confusing when you actually get a dump of those packets. So it's like often it's that's not actually what you want. You want a little more intelligence about, you know, where your virtual machine is and, you know, kind of where you're snooping and what you're snooping. So, again, you know, VLANs are an answer to this. Doesn't seem to work all that well. Another instance is you can migrate per connection state. This is a cool idea. You have to modify enforcement elements. VMware is starting to put out this API. It's called VMSafe, and one of the things they let you do is say, you know, with, associated with this VM is some state for my, you know, my enforcement element is using. When I migrate this VM around, that state is going to get migrated around with my VM. I'm going to be talking about, a little more about this afternoon. I'm taking over Oded's slot because of the fact that he's busy. His wife is having a baby or something. So if you want to hear kind of more about you know, dealing with some of these problems, I'll have more to say then. You can try to migrate your enforcement elements. This is kind of heavyweight. You can say, you know, I have a virtual firewall associated with this VM, and I'm going to move that firewall with a VM. Again, it's kind of a painful thing if you're having, I mean, because you have to now have like one enforcement element per VM. If you think about, you have one VM that's going to stay there and another one that's going to move, you can't sort of, you know, fork that VM into two instances. So things get a little janky. And another thing you could do is make routing smarter so that your middle box knows when I move this VM around, I need to continue routing my traffic intelligently to the closest enforcement element that's going to give me the policy that I want. That would be awesome. I hope in 5 years like or less, somebody actually gets around to doing that. Another problem with mobility is just the kind of ownership and accountability. You know, typically with a machine, you can say, when this thing got owned, I know who set this box up, where it's been. If it's like, you know, living on some physical machine, like, or if there's some physical machine that's going bad, I can just, you know, disable that port. With virtual machines, you know, again, because of these things move around, you don't necessarily know who to point the finger at. You don't know who to call up and say, like, turn off the port. Your machine is doing something weird. So this kind of, again, gets to this point of you need to have some additional infrastructure to keep track of, you know, where did this VM come from, what should be used for. Another interesting source of problems, and I feel like there's a whole talk on this later on today, I just read their abstract though, is, you know, kind of what happens to your TCB. If a machine was compromised, you know, at some point you had this collection of virtual machines, they lived on a host, some of those virtual machines are going to get moved, used off for something else, and then later on you figure out, wait, that machine was compromised. So when that machine was compromised, you know, what virtual machines were living there? Like, you know, where did that integrity violation kind of spread throughout my network? So it makes it really weird to think about, like, I mean, usually, you know, this physical box was owned, so that software was owned. With virtual machines, it gets kind of weirder, like, what was my TCP? When I found that, you know, box was owned, like, what happened? And then there's also this data lifetime question, right? As soon as you start migrating the stuff around, it's going to be, you know, paging stuff out onto disk. Well, I mean, well, it's all your virtual disks. Basically, you're taking your virtual disk and you're smearing it across, you know, your USB fob or different servers in your cluster or your desktop. So again, these questions of like, you know, where does my data live? When I want to, you know, when I want to, in a traditional infrastructure, you know, I have a box that was handling, you know, sensitive data, credit card numbers, that stuff we don't want the Chinese to see, that's kept in Maryland, like whatever. I take that box, you know, I destroy the hard drive, I, you know, overwrite stuff with zeros, run it through a giant magnetic field, whatever I do, destroy it, it's done. With a virtual machine, again, you have to think about, okay, where, you know, where did this thing live? So again, you sort of, from sort of an integrity and a secrecy standpoint, things get smeared all over. Another fun thing you encounter is virtual time. This is kind of a fun one because it has crypto stuff that goes with it. So normal time tends to be pretty sequential. Things march monotonically forward. With virtual time, you can take a machine, you can roll it back. At one point, you had a given machine state, you can fork it, you know, to n different copies, and they're going to go off and do different things. And this breaks a lot of stuff. Many practical things don't like being rolled back. Patches, AV signature files, lots of things get really unhappy if you decide, okay, I was going to throw out that configuration state. I mean, it's sort of like an intuitive thing. There's a number of solutions to this. You can move your configuration state out of your VM. You can move that functionality into a VM that you say this thing never gets rolled back. I did some work a while back on what we called virtualization-aware file systems. This is a file, like, instead of kind of managing things at the virtual disk level, you manage things at, you know, an entire file system level, and then you can say for given files, you know, I'm going to roll back the whole file system except for these files that are going to be marching monotonically forward. But in general, it's kind of a dicey thing. Another thing that really doesn't like being rolled back, aside from configuration state, is crypto stuff, right? So there's some things like, you know, if you guys have used S key, you have this one-time password, you put it in, and the assumption is that, you know, once that password has been seen, it's never going to be seen again. As soon as you take your machine and you roll it back, that machine is like, aha, you know, the next password that's going to be the good password is the one that you just input, and my attackers have already seen that. So unfortunately, we can't roll back an attacker's memory. It's sort of the key insight here. And lots of crypto kind of generally relies on the fact that things go marching monotonically forward. So S key is the trivial example. Stream ciphers, if you that random number is your session key, you reuse that session key, you get what are called two-time pad attacks. Basically, things just kind of break horribly. Well, it's kind of theoretical, and I'm kind of curious if you could actually force somebody in this situation where you could use this, is you could end up using TCP initial sequence numbers and do connection hijacking. This is, you know, totally theoretical, and yeah, I don't know. If you have some ideas on how to set up a scenario, we can make it work. I'd be interested to hear. DSS has assumptions. Anything signature scheme based on zero knowledge proofs of knowledge. The simplest answer for some of this stuff is just like certain types of crypto just probably shouldn't be used in virtualized environments. The good news is that, you know, mostly people today use stuff like RSA that works just fine and doesn't have these assumptions about time. But if some point people decide to roll out some of these wackier crypto systems, we should be like slow down there, cowboy. Final interesting thing, and I think Hoff spent some time talking about this. Hopefully, he didn't expect me to spend more time talking about this because I didn't have like lots of slides on this. But these sort of, you know, will it virtualize? We have these big boxes that sit in our network. They cost like $50,000, $100,000. We get them from people like Tipping Point. They like do crazy like layer 7, you know, reconstructing flow foo. Some of them have FPGAs. Some of them have dedicated ASICs. People like to virtualize all this stuff. You know, the kind of vision with virtualization is not just pick up a machine and move it, but pick up your whole data center, be able to move it for disaster recovery, for, you know, outsourcing the, you know, their actual compute resources to some, you know, provider in the cloud, because that's the new hotness. So the problem is that this, you know, this hardware that you're like, well, I'm just going to virtualize everything in my network. I'll virtualize my NAS. I'll virtualize my machines. Like, some of this stuff doesn't really want to be virtualized. And kind of, you know, whether you can scale this stuff up or whether you can just scale it out is kind of an open question. Like, we don't know if, you know, maybe if you have more virtual machines doing less, if this will work or not. And at line speeds. Again, you know, performance is really critical. So this is, it's kind of, this is an open research topic. This is not a, you know, things are good or things are bad, rather that, like, you can't virtualize everything today. Like, fundamentally, we don't know if you can. But it's a, you know, again, an area where you sort of have to scratch your chin. Again, will it virtualize, period, is always a good question. Oh, I guess the final one is kind of, you know, how do you deal with inter-VM traffic, right? You have these boxes you're using today. And if you want your traffic to continue, so when you have these collection of virtual machines, mostly they're talking to each other, they can be talking both to each other and to stuff off the box. So if they're talking to each other, how do you take that physical enforcement element and actually impose that between your virtual machines? The short answer to that is today, mostly people don't enforce a lot of stuff between those machines anyway, so maybe it doesn't matter. But maybe going forward, this will actually be an interesting question. We will need to be able to figure out, can we virtualize these things? So my general wrap-up, I think this... this talk wasn't, didn't have quite the scare factor. I think there's a lot of kind of interesting challenges in this space. To the extent that we can deal with these challenges quickly, it will affect, how quickly can we march forward with virtualization, right? If people are like, I have to totally throw out my security infrastructure if I want to virtualize, they're simply not going to do it. But, for all the folks out there that are with the press, I wanted to have this last slide. Get undetectable malware is coming. Be afraid. Lots of hype. Brad and Angelina will break up because of the use of virtualization. And actually, if anybody's going to be writing an article about this, that's really the headline I want. Security expert says, Brad and Angelina going to break up because of virtualization. So I hope we have some time for questions. I'd really like to hear from you guys. Thanks for listening.